Do you trust? Do you have confidence?
Let me make sure I understand this again. You are not telling me to be friends with those kids. Have I got it right?
Yes. 3 years ago, on that last day when everything was covered with a blanket of white snow, I explained the difference between trust and confidence. Do you remember?
Trust and confidence? You just keep changing the subject. Yes, of course I remember that, and I've always kept it in mind. It was a fascinating insight.
Now, let's go back over it again in your own words. How would you explain trust?
All right. Simply put, trust is believing in the other party with conditions. For example, when one borrows money from a bank, it goes without saying that the bank will not lend you money unconditionally. They will ask for some kind of collateral, such as real estate or a guarantor, and give you a loan that corresponds to the value of that. And they'll slap on the interest, too. This is an attitude of, we'll lend to you because we believe in the value of the collateral you've given us, not one of, we'll lend to you because we believe in you. In other words, they are not believing in that person. They are believing in the conditions of that person.
What about confidence?
It is doing without any set conditions whatsoever when believing in others. Even though one might not have sufficient grounds for believing, one believes. One believes unconditionally, without concerning oneself with such things as collateral. That is confidence. Instead of believing in the conditions of that person, one believes in that person. You could even say that one focuses not on material worth, but on human worth.
I see.
Furthermore, if I may supplement this explanation with my own interpretation, it is also to believe in oneself who believes in that person. Because how can one ask for anything like collateral if one does not have confidence in one's own judgment? It is a confidence in others that cannot exist without self-confidence.
Thank you very much. You've summed it up wonderfully.
I'm a pretty good student, aren't I? Look, I spent a long time following Adler, and I gleaned a lot from his writings. And most important, I have put his ideas into practice in an educational setting. So I am not rejecting Adler in an emotional way without a basis of understanding.
Of course you are not, but please do not misunderstand me here. You are neither my disciple nor my student.
So, insolent fellows like me aren't your disciples, is that it? What a masterpiece this is. I'm getting an Adler advocate angry.
It is clear that you are a lover of wisdom. Without shying away from doubt or from thinking with your own words, you move forward to attain higher understanding. In other words, you are a lover of wisdom, a philosopher. And I am not a person who confers teachings from above. I am nothing more than a wisdom-loving philosopher on the same level as you.
You are a philosopher without a teacher or disciples who is my equal. Then it's possible that you could recognize your errors and adopt my views?
Of course it is. I hope to learn many things from you. In fact, there are fresh discoveries each time we talk.
Huh. Just because you're flattering me doesn't mean I'm going to let up on the criticism. Now, why did you bring up trust and confidence?
The life tasks of work, friendship, and love that Adler upholds are delineated by the distance and depth of our interpersonal relationships.
Yes, you explained that before.
Even so, though one can say distance and depth in a single breath, these are things that are hard to grasp. There are many aspects that you have probably misunderstood. Please think about it in a simple manner like this. The difference between work and friendship is it trust or is it confidence?
Trust or confidence?
Right. Work relationships are relationships of trust, and friend relationships are relationships of confidence.
What do you mean?
Work relationships are condition-based relationships that involve either some vested interest or external factors, cooperating with someone because we happen to be at the same company, for example. Or there's a person whose personality you don't like, but is someone you do business with, so you maintain and promote the relationship. but you have no intention of maintaining that relationship away from work. This is truly a relationship of trust that is formed as a result of the vested interest that is your work. Regardless of your individual preferences, you have to form that relationship. On the other hand, in friendship, there is no reason to befriend this person. It is not a vested interest, and neither is it a relationship that is compelled by external factors. It is purely a relationship formed out of the intrinsic motivation that I like this person. To borrow the phrase you used earlier, one is believing in that person, not in the conditions of that person. Clearly, friendship is a relationship of confidence.
Ah, it's getting tiresome again. If that's the case, why did Adler use such words as work and friendship? He could have just discussed interpersonal relationships in terms of trust, confidence, and love from the start. You're just complicating things and trying to blow smoke.
All right. I will explain as simply as possible the reason that Adler chose the word work.
The youth was sure of it.
Adler probably regards poverty as a virtue, and economic activity in general as something vulgar. That's why he can disparage work and say things like, build friendship relationships with your students. What a joke.
The youth was just as proud to be a career professional as he was to be an educator.
It is precisely because we engage in education as a profession and not out of enjoyment or charity that we are able to responsibly execute our professional duties.
His coffee cup had been empty for a long time, and the night was far advanced. Nevertheless, the youth's eyes shone with burning intensity. Why work becomes a life task.
Let me ask you this. In the first place, what was Adler's opinion with regard to work? Did he look down on work or on the earning of money through work? You know, if Adlerian psychology, with its tendency toward empty idealism, is to become a true, grounded theory, this is a discussion that is absolutely necessary.
To Adler, the meaning of engaging in work was simple. Work is a means of production for staying alive in our Earth's harsh, natural environments. That is to say, he thought of work as a task quite directly linked to survival.
Well, that's rather banal. It's just work so that you can eat?
Yes. When we think of surviving, of eking out a living, the fact that we humans must engage in some kind of labor is a self-evident truth. On that basis, Adler focused on the paradigm of the interpersonal relationship that establishes work.
What do you mean?
In the absence of sharp teeth, wings for soaring the skies, or sturdy shells, the human being in the natural world is basically physically inferior to all other animals. That is why we have chosen to live in groups and learned to protect ourselves from outside enemies. In groups, we have lived and raised our children while hunting, engaging in agriculture, securing our food supply, and maintaining our physical security. The answer that Adler derived from this is embodied in a brilliant few words.
What conclusion did he come to?
We humans did not just herd together. Humans discovered the revolutionary way of working called division of labor. Division of labor is the incomparable survival strategy that the human race acquired in order to compensate for its physical inferiority. This is Adler's final conclusion.
Division of labor?
If we only herded together, that would be no different from what most animals do. But humans herded together on the basis of an advanced system of division of labor. Or one could say that we created society in order to divide up the labor. To Adler, the work tasks were not mere tasks of labor, they were tasks of the division of labor that were premised on our connection with others.
So it is because of its premise on our connection with others that work is a task of interpersonal relationships?
That's right. Why do humans work? in order to survive and stay alive in the harsh natural world? Why do humans create society in order to work and divide up the labor? Living, working, and building society are all inseparable. Before Adler, the division of labor was explored by others, such as Adam Smith, who pointed out its significance from the standpoint of economics. Adler, however, was likely the first to recognize the division of labor in the field of psychology. Moreover, it was he who saw its significance as the paradigm of interpersonal relationships. It is thanks to this key concept that the meaning of labor to humans and the meaning of society have become clear.
Ah, this is an extremely important matter. Please, go into a bit more detail.
Adler's inquiries always start with the same major points. To quote Adler, "Perhaps if we lived on another planet which gave everything easily and bountifully, working would not be a virtue. Perhaps it would be a vice, and being lazy would be a virtue."
He says some funny things. And then?
But there is no such environment on our planet. Our food supply is limited, and no one is going to provide us with dwelling places. So, what do? We work. And we do not work alone, but with our comrades. In conclusion, Adler states, "The answer that is logical and in accord with common sense is that we should work, cooperate, and contribute."
That's a thoroughly logical conclusion.
The important thing here is that Adler is not stipulating that labor itself is right. Regardless of moral right and wrong, we have no choice but to work, and no choice but to engage in the division of labor. We have no choice but to build relationships with others.
So I guess it's a conclusion that goes beyond morality.
In other words, human beings cannot live alone. It is not that we cannot bear loneliness or that we want people to talk to, so much as simply not being able to live on the level of survival. And in order to divide labor with another person, one must believe in that person. One cannot cooperate with someone whom one doubts.
That is a relationship of trust?
Yes. Human beings do not have the choice of not believing in each other. It would be impossible for us to not cooperate and not divide up the labor. A relationship not of cooperating because one likes that person, but of having to cooperate whether one likes it or not. You can think of it that way.
Fascinating. No, I mean it. This is wonderful. I'm finally getting the work relationship. Division of labor is necessary for living, and mutual trust is necessary in order to carry it out. And there is no alternative. We cannot live alone, and not trusting is not an option. We have no choice but to build relationships. That's how it is, right?
Yes, it truly is a life task.
All professions are honorable.
Well, let's really get to the heart of the matter. A relationship in which there is no alternative but trust. A relationship in which there is no alternative but to cooperate. This is something that goes beyond the actual setting where labor takes place, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I suppose the most easily understood example would be the typical division of labor relationships among teammates at sports competitions and the like. In order to win a match, they have no choice but to cooperate, regardless of their individual likes and dislikes. It is not an option to ignore someone because one doesn't like them, or to sit out a game because one can't get along with one's teammates, or anything like that. You forget liking and not liking the moment the match begins. You treat your teammate not as a friend, but as one of the functions of the team, and you yourself try to excel as one of those functions.
Ability is given precedence over good relations.
Such aspects are probably unavoidable. So much so that Adam Smith himself declares self-interest to lie at the very foundation of division of labor.
Self-interest?
Suppose there's a man who is an expert at making bows and arrows. If you use the bows and arrows he makes, your rate of accuracy will improve drastically, and your ability to kill or wound will be enhanced as well. The thing is, he's not an expert at hunting. He is slow on his feet, has weak eyesight, and is just not good at hunting, even with his own excellent bows and arrows. And then, one day, it occurs to him, I'll devote my time to making bows and arrows.
Huh. Why?
If he devotes his time to making bows and arrows, he should be able to make a few dozen of them per day. If he distributes them to comrades who are good at hunting, they will probably shoot down more game than they ever have before. Later, he can get his share of the game they bring back home. That is the choice that allows for the maximization of profit for both parties.
I see. So, it's not just working together. It's everyone being in charge of their own field of expertise.
From the hunting expert's point of view, there would be nothing better than getting their hands on some highly accurate bows and arrows. They won't have to make the bows and arrows themselves, and they'll be able to concentrate on hunting. And then they'll divvy up the game they catch with everyone. In this way, they will perfect a more advanced division of labor system that is one step beyond going hunting in a group.
That's certainly rational.
The important thing here is that no one is sacrificing themselves. That is to say, the combination of pure self-interest is establishing the division of labor. As a result of everyone having pursued self-interest, a fixed economic order is created. This is the division of labor that was devised by Adam Smith.
In a division of labor society, if we follow self-interest all the way, ultimately, it connects to other interest.
That's right.
But Adler is recommending contribution to others, isn't he? 3 years ago, you asserted this point quite forcefully, that the aim to contribute to others is a grand compass of life, a guiding star. Doesn't the idea of giving precedence to one's own profit contradict contribution to others?
It does not contradict it at all. First, one embarks on work relationships. One is tied to other people and to society by interest. And so it is only upon having pursued self-interestedness that one finds contribution to others.
Even so, if one is engaged in role-sharing, surely superiority and inferiority will arise there, won't they? Say there's one person who has an important job, and another who has a job that doesn't really matter. Doesn't this deviate from the principle of equality?
No, it does not deviate from it at all. Viewed from the standpoint of the division of labor, all professions are honorable. Whether prime minister, business owner, farmer, factory worker, or the oft-ignored profession of housewife, all work is something that has to be done by someone in the community, and all of us are just doing our share of that work.
So all forms of work are of equal value?
Yes. To paraphrase Adler with regard to the division of labor, a person's worth is decided by the way in which they fulfill their role in assigning the division of labor in their community. In other words, a person's worth is not something that is decided by what kind of work they engage in. It is decided by the attitude with which they undertake that work.
The attitude with which they undertake it?
For example, you quit your job as a librarian and chose the path of an educator. Today, you have dozens of students in front of you, and you truly feel that you have been entrusted with their lives. You feel that you have a really big job that is useful to society. Perhaps you even think that education is everything, and that other professions are insignificant in comparison. But when one considers the community as a whole, the librarian's work, the middle school teacher's work, and all other work is something that has to be done by someone in the community, and no superior or inferior can exist there. If anyone is going to be superior or inferior, it will only be in the attitude with which they undertake that work.
What is the attitude with which they undertake the work in such a case?
In principle, each person's ability is treated as important within the division of labor relationship. When it comes to company employment, for example, the level of ability becomes a criterion. There is no denying this. However, after starting the division of labor, ability alone is insufficient for character evaluation or for judging how relationships should be. Rather, the question, "Do I want to work with this person?" becomes important, because if it does not, it will become difficult to help each other. The major factor in deciding, "Do I want to work with this person?" or "Do I want to help when this person is having a hard time?" is that person's integrity and the attitude with which they undertake work.
Okay, so if one undertakes it with integrity and sincerity, there is no difference in worth between the person who performs life-saving work and the person who takes advantage of others' weaknesses and engages in usurious lending?
No, there is no difference.
Huh.
Our community has all manner of work available, and the presence of people there who engage in each kind of work is crucial. That diversity itself is abundance. If the work is one that has no value, it will not be needed by anyone and will be done away with. If it has not been done away with and is still surviving, it must possess some value.
Does that mean that even usurious lending has value?
It is natural that one might think so. The most dangerous thing is to uphold a mediocre justice that declares what is good and what is bad. A person who is drunk on justice will be unable to recognize anyone else's values and will end up crusading for the intervention of justice. What lies ahead with such intervention is a society of uniform grayness that is robbed of freedom. You can do whatever kind of work you like, and it does not matter what kind of work other people do either.
The important thing is what use one makes of that equipment.
Interesting. This thing you're calling the Adlerian division of labor is certainly an interesting concept. The human being in the natural world is much too weak to live alone. That is why we formed groups and came up with the way of working called division of labor. When we carry out the division of labor, we can bring down a mammoth, and we can farm and build dwellings.
That's right.
And the division of labor begins by trusting others, regardless of one's likes and dislikes. We cannot live if we don't divide up the labor. We cannot live if we don't cooperate with other people, which is another way of saying that we cannot live without trusting others. This is the division of labor relationship, and the work relationship.
Yes. Take the rules of traffic on public roads, for example. It is on the basis of our trust that all people follow the rules of traffic that we pass through a green light. We are not having confidence in people unconditionally. We do look to the left and right first. But even then, we are placing a certain trust in other people whom we have never met. In a sense, this too is a work relationship in that it is fulfilling a shared interest in the smooth flow of traffic.
I see. I guess that works. At this point, I can't find anything about the division of labor that needs to be refuted. But have you forgotten? The departure point of this discussion was your remark that I should build friend relationships with my students.
No, I have not forgotten.
But, considered in the context of the division of labor, your argument makes less sense than ever. Why on earth would I enter into friendship relationships with my students? Clearly, it's a work relationship, isn't it? Neither I nor my students have any memory of having chosen each other. It's just a relationship that was mechanically assigned between people who were originally complete strangers. We have no choice but to cooperate, though, in order to run the classroom and fulfill the objective of graduation. It is truly a work relationship that is entered into with a common interest.
I think it is only natural to have such doubts. Now, let's go over each of the points we have discussed today. What is the objective of education? What is the work that is required of the educator? Our discussion began with these questions. Adler's conclusion is a simple one. The objective of education is self-reliance, and the work that is required of the educator is assistance toward self-reliance. I believe that you agreed with this point.
Yes, I'll allow it, in any case.
Then, in what way can one assist children to gain self-reliance? In response to this doubt, I spoke about starting from respect.
Indeed, you did.
Why respect? What is it? Here, we must recall the words of Erich Fromm, namely, that respect is the ability to see a person as they are and the placing of worth on that person being that person.
Of course I remember.
Have regard for the person as they are. You are fine, just as you. There is no need to be special. There is value in you just being you. Through respect, and by conveying that, the children will regain the courage they had lost and begin climbing the steps of self-reliance.
Yes, that's our discussion in a nutshell.
Now, this is the definition of respect that has emerged here, to have regard for the person as they are. Is it trust that lies at the very root of respect, or is it confidence?
Huh?
One has regard for that person as they are without imposing one's own system of values. The reason one can do such a thing is that one is accepting and believing that person unconditionally. In other words, one is having confidence in them.
Respect and confidence are synonymous?
One could say that. Put the other way around, one cannot have confidence in someone whom one does not respect. Whether or not one can have confidence in someone depends on whether or not one respects that person.
Ah, I get it. The gateway to education is respect, and respect is confidence. Therefore, a relationship based on confidence is a friend relationship. It's that sort of syllogism, right?
That's right. One would not be able to respect one's students in a trust-based work relationship, and that is exactly how it is for you now.
No, that is not where the issue lies. I can place unconditional confidence in my best friend, for example. I can accept him as the person he is. It's possible enough in such a case. The issue is not the act of having confidence, but the target. You are telling me to build friend relationships with all my students and to have unconditional confidence in all my students. Do you think that such a thing is really possible?
Of course I do.
How?
Suppose, for example, a person who is critical of everyone around them, saying, I don't like this thing about so-and-so, and this aspect of that person is unbearable and such. And then they lament over it. Ah, I'm so unlucky. I'm not blessed when it comes to meeting people. Are such people really not blessed when it comes to meeting people? No, absolutely not. It is not that they are not blessed with comrades. It is only that they have not tried to make comrades, or in other words, that they have not tried to embark on interpersonal relationships.
So one can become a comrade to anyone?
One can. Maybe the relationship between you and your students is one of all of you due to accidental factors just happening to be in that place. Maybe until that time you were all total strangers who didn't even know each other's faces or names. And maybe you won't become what you call best friends. But remember that statement of Adler's. The important thing is not what one is born with, but what use one makes of that equipment. Regardless of who the other person is, one can give them respect and one can believe in them, because that is something that is the product of one's single-minded resolve and is not affected by the environment or the target.
So, it's that again? You're returning to the problem of courage? You're saying it's the courage to believe?
Yes. Everything comes back to that.
No, it doesn't. You don't know about real friendship.
What do you mean?
You don't have true close friends, and you don't know about real friendship, and that's why you can talk about such pipe dreams. I'll bet you've never had anything but shallow associations with people. That's why you can say that anyone will do. You're the one who's been running away from interpersonal relationships and from your life tasks.
In the natural world, the human being is such a small and feeble creature. To make up for that weakness, humans created society and brought forth division of labor. Division of labor is an incomparable survival strategy that is unique to the human race. This was the division of labor conveyed by Adler. If the discussion had ended there, the youth would have applauded Adler enthusiastically. But when it came to the friendship that the philosopher began presenting next, he was far from convinced.
This guy can talk about such a well-grounded division of labor, and then, in the next breath, change the subject to friendship and start espousing ideals after all. And now, he brings up courage again.
How many close friends do you have?
So, you have a best friend, don't you?
I don't know how he feels about it, but I do have one friend in whom I have what you call unconditional confidence.
What kind of person is he?
He was my classmate at university. The guy wanted to become a novelist, and I was always the first to read his work. Late at night, when everyone else was sound asleep, he'd show up out of the blue at the boarding house where I lived and say, his voice shaking with excitement, "Read this short story I just completed." Or, "Hey, I found this amazing passage in a Dostoevsky novel." Even now, he still sends me new pieces of writing every time he finishes them. And when I got hired as an instructor, he celebrated with me.
Was this fellow a close friend of yours from the start?
How could he have been? Friendship is something that takes time to cultivate. He didn't become a close friend overnight. We laughed together, marveled at things together, and it grew into an ever so slightly complicit relationship. We cultivated the friendship gradually and became close friends, while also going through some intense conflicts at times.
So, in other words, at some point, he was elevated from being a friend to being a close friend. Was there something that led to your thinking of him as a close friend?
I wonder. If I had to, I guess I'd say it was when I felt sure that, with this guy, it'll be okay to talk frankly about everything.
You cannot talk frankly about everything with a normal friend?
That's how it is for everyone. All people go through life wearing a social mask. People go through life hiding their true feelings. Even with a friend you can exchange smiles and jokes each time you meet, you never get to see his real face. We choose our subjects of conversation, our attitudes, and our words. All of us interact with our friends while wearing a social mask.
Why can't you take off the mask when you are with a normal friend?
Because if I did such a thing, the relationship would fall apart. You can talk all you want about the courage to be disliked and such, but there's no such thing as a person who would actually wish to be disliked. We wear the mask to prevent needless conflict from arising and to prevent the relationship from falling apart. If we don't do that, society won't operate.
To put it more directly, are we avoiding being hurt?
Yes, I'll acknowledge that. Certainly, I don't want to get hurt, and I don't want to hurt someone else, but you see, it isn't only out of self-protection that we wear the mask. It's actually more out of kindness. If we were to live only with our real faces and our true feelings, we would hurt too many people. Just imagine what the world would be like if everyone were crashing their true feelings into each other. It's a perfect picture of hell with blood spattered all around.
But you can take off the mask when you are with your close friend, and even if that leads to you hurting each other, the relationship won't fall apart, will it?
Sure. I can take it off, and the relationship won't fall apart. Even if he commits a faux pas once or twice, I don't think that would be reason enough to sever my relationship with him, because the relationship is based on accepting each other's strengths and shortcomings.
That is a wonderful relationship.
And the important thing is that there are precious few people in the world who will allow us to have such a sense of certainty. One would be lucky to find even five during one's lifetime. Well, please, get to my question. Do you have any true close friends? Because from the way you talk, you really sound like a person who doesn't know anything about close friends or about friendship, and only has comrades he knows from books and daydreams.
Yes, of course, I have several close friends, and to borrow your words, they are people with whom I can have my real face, or even if they commit a faux pas once or twice, I don't think that would be reason enough to sever my relationship.
Huh. What kind of people are they? School friends? Comrades in philosophy or in Adlerian research?
For example, you.
Huh? What did you say?
As I've said before, to me, you are an irreplaceable friend. I've never worn a mask in your presence.
So, does that mean that you have unconditional confidence in me?
Of course I do. If I did not, this dialogue would not be able to take place.
No way!
It's the truth.
This isn't a joke. You think you can get away with manipulating a person's heart this way? You phony wise man! I'm not the kind of person who's taken in by such honeyed words.
First, believe.
Why are you so adamant in your denial of confidence?
But it's the other way around. I wish you'd tell me, what is the point in believing in a complete stranger, and in believing in them without conditions? To believe in someone unconditionally is to be unquestioning of others, and to believe in them blindly. It is the same as saying one should just become an obedient sheep.
You are wrong. Believing is not just swallowing everything one hears, hook, line, and sinker. One is skeptical with regard to that person's thoughts and beliefs, and to the statements he makes. One steps back for a moment and thinks for oneself. There is nothing wrong with doing so, and it is important work. On top of that, even if someone is telling lies, one must believe in the whole person who lies to us.
Huh?
Believe in others. This is not the passive conduct of swallowing something hook, line, and sinker. Real confidence is, in all respects, an active approach.
What are you saying?
For example, I would like as many people as possible to learn of Adler's ideas. I hope to present Adler's words. However, this wish is not something that can be realized through my labor alone. It is something that forms upon there being a will to listen on the part of the person who receives my words and on the part of the person who listens deeply to them. Then, in what way can I get someone to receive and listen deeply to my words? I cannot force them and say, believe in me. That person is free to believe or not to believe. The only thing I can do is believe in the other party to whom I am speaking. That is all.
Believe in the other party?
Yes. If I were to speak to you about Adler with a sense of distrust, it'd just go in one ear and out the other. Regardless of the validity of my discourse, you would have no intention of listening from the very start. That would be perfectly natural. But I want you to believe in me. I want you to believe in me and listen to Adler's words. So I will believe in you first, even if you yourself are trying not to believe.
You want me to believe in you, so you believe in me first?
Right. Take, for example, when parents who do not have confidence in their children are worrying about various things. Even if their arguments are quite reasonable ones, they do not reach the children. Actually, the more reasonable the arguments are, the more the children want to oppose them. Why do they oppose them? Because their parents don't actually see them at all. And even as they're in the midst of distrusting themselves, they're getting all the standard lectures.
Reasonable arguments not being understood as such is something I am well aware of on a daily basis.
We try not to believe only in the words of a person who will believe in me. We do not judge the other party by the rightness of their opinion.
I'll accept that that aspect exists, but the rightness of your opinion is going to be questioned in the end.
All conflicts, from a small quarrel to a war between nations, arise as a result of collisions of my justice. Justice is something that takes on all manner of forms depending on the era, the environment, or individual standpoints. And no matter where one may go, there is never only one justice or one solution. It would seem that it is dangerous to overestimate rightness. Within that, we are looking to find common ground. We are looking for a connection with other people. We are hoping to join hands. If you want to join hands with others, you have to reach out with your hands too.
No, that's another arrogant notion. Why? Because when you say you believe in me, what you're thinking is, so believe in me too, right?
No, I am not. It is not something one can force. I believe in you, whether you believe in me or not. I keep on believing. That is the meaning of unconditional.
How about right now? I do not believe in you. Even after being so firmly rejected and verbally abused with cruel words, can you still completely believe in me?
Of course I can. I believe in you just as I did 3 years ago. If I did not, we would not be able to engage in discussion for such a long time and with such earnestness. A person who does not believe in others cannot engage in direct discussion. Such a person would not think, with this guy, it'll be okay to talk frankly about everything, as you so admirably put it.
This is impossible. There is no way I can believe in such words.
That is fine. I will just go on believing. I will believe in you, and I will believe in human beings.
Oh, shut up. So, you're a religious type now?
People never understand each other.
I have said this before, but I am not a follower of any particular religion. However, in both Christianity and Buddhism, in such ways of thought that have been cultivated and refined over a period of several thousand years, there is a power that cannot be ignored. It is because they contain uniform truths that they have not been done away with and still survive today. For example, do you know the "love thy neighbor" phrase from the Bible?
Yes, of course. It's that neighborly love that you enjoy talking about so much.
This phrase is in circulation with an important part left out. In the Gospel of Luke, in the New Testament of the Bible, it says, "Love thy neighbor as thyself."
As thyself?
That's right. He is saying not just to love one's neighbor, but to love them as much as one loves oneself. If one cannot love oneself, one cannot love others. If one cannot believe in oneself, one cannot believe in others. Please think of the phrase as carrying that connotation. You are insisting that you cannot believe in other people, but that is because you have not managed to truly believe in yourself.
You're making too many assumptions.
Being self-centered does not mean looking only at oneself because one likes oneself. In actuality, the opposite is the case, and it is because one is unable to accept oneself as one is, and because one is constantly beset with anxiety, that one has concern only for oneself.
So, you're saying that because I hate myself, I look only at myself?
Yes, that's right.
Oh, what an unpleasant psychology!
It is the same with regard to other people. For example, when recalling a lover one had a bad breakup with, for a while, it's only the bad things about the other person that come to mind. This is evidence that you want to feel, "I'm glad we broke up," and that some uncertainty remains about your decision. If you don't tell yourself, "I'm glad we broke up," you might lose your resolve. See it as being that kind of stage. And if you recall the good points about a former lover, that means you do not have the need to actively dislike that person and can be free from feelings toward that person. Either way, the issue is not whether one likes or dislikes the other person, but whether one likes oneself now. You have not yet learned to like yourself. As a result, you cannot believe in others, you cannot believe in your students, and you are unable to embark on friend relationships. That is exactly why you are now trying to gain a sense of belonging through your work. You are trying to prove your worth by being successful in your work.
What is wrong with that? Recognition at work is recognition from society.
No, In principle, we may say that it is your functions that are recognized as a result of your work, not you. If someone who possesses greater functions appears, the people around you will turn to that person. That is the principle of the marketplace, the principle of competition. As a result of that, you will never be able to get out of the vortex of competition and never gain a true sense of belonging.
Then how can one gain a true sense of belonging?
One has confidence in other people and one embarks on friend relationships. That is the only way. We cannot gain happiness solely by dedicating ourselves to our work.
But even if I believe in someone, there's no way to know if that person will have confidence in me or if that person will embark on a friend relationship with me.
This is the separation of tasks. How that other person feels about you and what sort of attitude they take toward you are the other person's tasks and are not something you have any control over.
No way. That doesn't make sense. Because if we are going to treat the separation of tasks as a prerequisite, wouldn't that mean that we never really know each other?
It is a given that it is not possible to know everything that the other party is thinking. One believes in another person as an unknowable being. That is confidence. We humans are beings who cannot know each other, and that is exactly why believing is the only way.
Aha! So everything you're saying is religion after all.
Adler was a thinker who had the courage to believe in human beings. Actually, given the situation he was placed in, maybe he had no choice but to believe.
What do you mean?
This is the perfect opportunity for us to take a look back at the circumstances that led Adler to put forward his concept of community feeling. Why, in the face of criticism, did Adler advance this idea? Naturally, he had a substantial reason.
Life is made up of trials of nothing days.
After parting ways with Freud in 1913, the year before the outbreak of World War I, Adler named his psychological approach individual psychology. One might say that Adlerian psychology at its inception was drawn into the war.
Did Adler serve in the war?
Yes, he did. When World War I began, Adler, who was 44 at the time, was conscripted as a medical officer and served in the Department of Neurology and Psychology at a military hospital. His job as a medical officer was one and one only: to provide treatment to the soldiers in his care and to return them to the front lines as soon as possible.
To return them to the front. Well, the purpose of giving them treatment is pretty clear.
You're quite right. The soldiers he treated were sent back to the front, and without that treatment, there was no way they would ever have been able to return to society. For Adler, who as a child had lost a younger brother and had dreamed of becoming a doctor, the duties of a medical officer must have been distressing in the extreme. Later, Adler said of his time as a medical officer, "I felt throughout the war as a prisoner feels."
I can barely imagine how difficult a role it must have been for him.
World War I, which was begun as the war to end all wars, progressed into an unprecedented, all-out war that devastated Europe and involved even non-combatants. It goes without saying that this tragedy had a great effect on Adler and other psychologists of his time.
Concretely speaking, how?
Freud, for example, after the experience of the war, proposed the existence of the death drive, which would become known as thanatos or destrudo. This is a concept that has been subjected to all manner of interpretation, but it may be best understood as the destructive impulse with regard to life.
Without considering the existence of such an impulse, there would be no way to explain the tragedies unfolding before them.
I suppose that is how it was. On the other hand, what Adler, who had experienced the same war directly from the standpoint of a medical officer, proposed was community feeling, which was quite the opposite of Freud. I would say that this is a particularly noteworthy point.
Why did he bring up community feeling at that time?
Adler was in all respects a practical person. One might say that he did not focus on war or murder or the causes of violence in the way that Freud did, but considered instead, in what way can we put a stop to war? Are we beings who long for war, for murder and violence? Surely not. If we can nurture community feeling, that is to say, the awareness that all people must have of regarding other people as comrades, we can prevent conflict. And furthermore, we have the power to accomplish that. Adler believed in people.
In his pursuit of such empty ideals, however, he was criticized as unscientific.
Yes, he received a great deal of criticism and lost many comrades. Adler was not unscientific, however. He was constructive. His principle was not what one is born with, but what use one makes of that equipment.
But wars are still occurring all over the world.
To be sure, Adler's ideals have yet to be realized. One wonders if they are actually realizable. Regardless, progressing toward those ideals is something that we can do. Just as a human being can always continue to grow as an individual, the entire human race should be able to continue growing. We must not use the unhappiness of our current situation as a reason for abandoning our ideals.
So, if we don't abandon our ideals, someday there will be no more war?
Mother Teresa, on being asked, "What can one do to promote world peace?" gave the following reply: "Go home and love your family." It is the same with Adler's community feeling. Instead of doing something for world peace, just have confidence in the person in front of you. Become comrades with that person in front of you. That daily, small accumulation of confidence will someday get rid of even conflict between nations.
All you need to think about is what's right in front of you?
For better or worse, that is the only place we can start from. If one wants to rid the world of conflict, one has to free oneself of conflict first. If you wish your students would believe in you, you need to believe in your students first. Instead of engaging in the whole story while leaving oneself out of it, one takes the first step as a part of the whole.
You spoke of this 3 years ago. You said you should start.
Yes. Someone has to start. Other people might not be cooperative, but that is not connected to you. My advice is this: you should start, with no regard to whether others are cooperative or not. This was Adler's answer to a question regarding the actual effectiveness of community feeling.
Will my first step change the world?
Maybe it will change, and maybe it will not. But one does not need to think now about what the results will be or anything like that. What you can do is have confidence in the people closest to you. That is all. Our trials and decisions as human beings do not come only with such symbolic life events as taking university entrance examinations, gaining employment, or getting married. For us, it is our nothing days that are our trial. And it is in everyday life, here and now, that the big decisions must be made. People who manage to get by and avoid those trials are unlikely to ever attain real happiness. Before arguing over the state of the world, have some thought for your neighbor. Have some thought for your interpersonal relationships on nothing days. That is all we can do.
So you mean love thy neighbor as thyself.
Give, and it shall be given unto you.
It seems there are still some points that you find unconvincing.
Unfortunately, there are quite a few. As you so aptly put it, my students do look down on me, but they aren't the only ones who do that. Almost nobody out there acknowledges that I have some worth, and they just ignore my existence. If they had regard for me and would listen to what I say, my attitude would probably change. And maybe it would even be possible to have confidence in them. But the reality is different. Those guys think little of me, and they always have. If there is one thing that can be done in such a situation, it is this: to have my worth acknowledged through my work. That is all. Confidence and respect and such, all that comes later.
So in other words, other people should have regard for one first, and then one becomes successful in one's work in order to gain the respect of others?
That's right.
I see. Well, think of it this way. Having unconditional confidence in other people, having respect for them, is a giving conduct.
Giving?
Yes. It should be easy to understand if we use money as an example instead. Basically, it is people in a position of affluence who can engage in giving something to others. If one does not have enough saved up, one cannot engage in giving.
Okay, when it comes to money, that makes sense.
And now, you are seeking only to have something given to you without having given anything. Just like a beggar. It is not that you are poor financially, but that you are poor in spirit.
You disrespectful son of a...
We have to keep our hearts abundant and give what we have saved up to others. We must not wait for respect from other people, but must ourselves have respect and confidence in them. We must not become poor-spirited.
An objective like that isn't philosophy, and it isn't psychology either.
Then let's take it even further and bring in a quote from the Bible. Are you familiar with the phrase, "Ask and it shall be given you"?
Yes. At least it's a phrase I've heard on occasion.
Adler would probably put it like this: "Give and it shall be given unto you."
Wow.
It is because of one's giving that one is given to. One must not wait to have something given to one. One must not become a beggar of the spirit. This is an extremely important viewpoint when considering one other interpersonal relationship continuing from work and friendship.
That one other, in terms of...
At the beginning today, I said the following: everything we are discussing may be summarized by love. There is no task that is stricter or more difficult or more testing of courage than the love that Adler speaks of. At the same time, however, the stairway to understanding Adler may be found by embarking on love. Actually, it is no exaggeration to say that that is the only way.
The stairway to understanding Adler.
Do you have the courage to climb it?
There is no way I can answer that unless you show me that stairway, or whatever it is. After that, I will decide whether to climb it or not.
All right. Then let's turn our attention to love, which is the final gateway in our life tasks and is also the stairway to understanding the ideas of Adler.
Part 5. Choose a life you love. The youth had to admit it was true. At the very beginning of the evening's discussion, the philosopher had informed him, "All the issues you are experiencing now may be summarized in the discussion of love." They had spent many hours talking together, and at long last, they had arrived at the issue of love.
What is there to talk about with this man concerning love, anyway? What do I even know about love in the first place?
Looking down, he found his notebook now filled with what appeared to be notes, written in a scrawl that he could barely make out himself. Feeling slightly unsure of himself, and finding the silence unbearable, the youth let out a laugh. Love is not something one falls into.
Still, it's kind of funny.
What is?
I can't help but laugh, you know? Two scruffy guys putting their heads together in this small study and trying to talk about love. In the middle of the night, no less.
Come to think of it, I suppose it is an unusual situation.
So, what will we talk about now? Maybe we should hear the story of your first love? The ruddy-faced young philosopher in love? What will become of him? It sounds interesting.
Direct talk of romance and love brings about embarrassment. You are young, and I know well that desire to be facetious, to cover it up. You're not the only one who does so. Many people fall silent when confronted by love and pass it off with lifeless generalizations. As a result, almost all the love that gets talked about does not quite grasp its actual state.
It's easy for you, huh? So, tell me, what's this lifeless generalization about love?
For example, the lofty love that is unforgiving of defilement and deifies the other person. Or, conversely, the animal love of succumbing to sexual drives. Or further, the biological love of intending to transmit one's genes to a new generation. Most representations of love in the world revolve around one of these types. To be sure, we can demonstrate a certain understanding of all these kinds of love. We can accept that there are such aspects. At the same time, however, we should be aware that something is missing, because all we hear about is conceptual divine love and instinctive animal love, and no one even attempts to speak of human love.
A human love that is neither divine nor animal.
Now, why does no one try to come to grips with human love? Why is it that people do not attempt to discuss real love? What is your view on this?
Well, I guess you're right about feeling embarrassed when it comes to talking about love, because it's the private thing that one wants to keep concealed most of all. If it's the kind of love for humanity that is steeped in religion, people are only too happy to talk about it. In a sense, it's someone else's affairs, and it's nothing more than impracticable theory anyway. But it's not so easy to speak about one's own love.
Because it is about an inextricably involved me?
Yes. It's something that feels as embarrassing as it would be to take off one's clothes and run around naked. And there's another reason as well. The moment of falling for someone is almost entirely the result of the action of the subconscious. So, no matter what, it is a bit of a stretch to explain it using logical language. I suppose it's the same as the audience member who is moved when seeing a play or a movie and cannot explain why they are crying. Because if the tears were so rational as to be explainable with words, they wouldn't flow in the first place.
I see. Romantic love is something one falls into. Love is an uncontrollable impulse, and we can only give ourselves over to being at the mercy of its tempest. Is that it?
Yes, of course. Love does not progress in a calculated way, and it is not something that can be controlled by anyone. And that's why tragedies like Romeo and Juliet end up occurring.
All right. I think that what you are talking about now is a view of love that is derived from normal social thinking. But Adler, who doubted the normal thinking of society, shed light from a different angle and, in effect, espoused antitheses to normal social thinking. His opinion with regard to love, for example, was that love is not, as some psychologists think, a pure and natural function.
What's that supposed to mean?
In short, love to the human being is neither something prescribed by destiny nor something spontaneously generated. That is to say, we do not fall in love.
Then what is it?
It is something we build. Love that is just falling, anyone can do. Such a thing is not worthy of being called a life task. It is because we build it up from nothing by our strength of will that the task of love is difficult. Many people try to speak of love without having any knowledge of this principle. As a result, they must resort to words like destiny, which is none of our human business, and animalistic instinct. They avoid looking directly at the task that should be most important to them as if it were beyond the scope of their will or effort. One may even say that they are not engaging in loving.
They're not engaging in loving?
That's right. This is probably also the case for you who talk of falling in love. We must think about the human love that is neither divine nor animal.
From An Art of Being Loved toward an art of loving.
I could refute that in all kinds of ways. Look, every one of us has been through the experience of falling for someone. I'm sure you are no exception. If you are a human living in this world, you experience again and again the tempest of love, that unstoppable impulse of love. In other words, falling in love definitely exists. You'll acknowledge this fact, won't you?
Think of it this way. Suppose there is a camera you want. You're fascinated by a German-made twin-lens reflex camera that you happen to see one day in a shop window. Though you have never touched the camera and don't even know how to focus its lens, you crave to possess it someday. You would carry it with you all the time and take pictures whenever the spirit moved you. It doesn't have to be a camera, shoes, a car, a musical instrument. It could be anything. You can imagine the feeling, right?
Yes, I know it well.
At this time, your obsession with that camera will be just like you're falling for someone, and you will be beset by a tempest of endless desire. When you close your eyes, its form comes to you, and in the farthest reaches of your ears, you can even hear the sound of the shutter. Your condition is such that no other thing can enter your head. If it were during childhood, you might have whined and cried about it to your parents.
Well, sure.
But when you actually get the camera, you get tired of it, not even 6 months later. Why do you tire of it so soon after finally getting it? It isn't that you wanted to photograph with a German camera. You just wanted to acquire, to possess, and to triumph. The falling in love you speak of is no different from this desire to possess or this desire for triumph.
So, in other words, falling for someone is like becoming obsessed with material things?
Of course, the other party is a living human being, so it should be easy to add in a romantic story. But essentially, it is the same as the desire for material things.
Ah, what a masterpiece.
What's wrong?
What do you know about people, anyway? Even as you preach neighborly love, out seeps this ridiculous stew of nihilism. What human love? What antitheses to normal social thinking? You can take those ideas and feed them to the rats in the sewers.
There are probably two points you have misunderstood with regard to the premise of this discussion. The first one is that you are focusing on the story of Cinderella in her glass slippers up until she gets married to the prince. Adler, on the other hand, is focused on their relationship after they get married, after the closing credits have passed and the movie is over.
Their relationship after they get married?
Yes. For example, even if their passionate love leads to marriage, that is not the goal of love. Marriage is really the starting point of their love, because real life will continue day after day from that point.
So the love that Adler talks about is married life?
Then there is the other point. Adler devoted much of his energy to giving lectures, and apparently the majority of the requests he received from his audience were love-related consultations. There are many psychologists in the world who advocate the art of being loved by another person, on how to be loved by the person one desires, and that may have been the sort of advice that people were expecting from Adler too. But the love that Adler spoke of was something completely different. Consistently, he advocated an active art of loving, that is to say, the art of loving another person.
An art of loving?
Yes. To understand this way of thinking, one may turn not only to Adler, but to the words of Erich Fromm as well. He even published a book by the same name, The Art of Loving, which was a worldwide bestseller. To be sure, it is difficult to be loved by another person, but loving another person is a task of far greater difficulty.
Who would believe such a joke? Loving is something any wretch is capable of. The difficult thing is to be loved. It's no exaggeration to say that the anxiety of love is summed up in that phrase.
I once thought so too, but now that I know Adler and have put his ideas into practice in child-rearing, and have come to know of the existence of a great love, I hold a view that is the complete opposite, This is an area that touches the core of Adler. When you know the difficulty of loving, you will understand everything about Adler.
Love is a task accomplished by two people.
No, I am not going to concede. If loving were the only thing, it could be done by anyone. No matter how warped a person's character, no matter how much of a failure they might be, that person has someone they long for. In other words, one can love another person, but being loved by another person is extremely difficult. I am a fine example. I look like this, and whenever there's a woman in front of me, I blush, my voice turns shrill, and my eyes get jittery. I don't have a good position in society, and not much in terms of finances either. And to make matters worse, I've got this cynical personality. Who could possibly love someone like me?
In your life until now, have you ever loved someone?
Sure I have.
Was it easy to love that person?
It's not a question of it being difficult or easy. Before you realize it, you're falling for someone, and then you're in love with that person and can't get them out of your head. That's just the emotion called love.
And do you love someone now?
No.
Why is that? It's easy to love, isn't it?
Damn it. Talking to you is like hanging out with a heartless machine. Loving is easy. Without a doubt, it is easy. However, finding the person one should love is difficult. That's the problem. Finding the person one should love. Once you find the person you should love, the tempest of love will start raging inside of you, a violent tempest that there's no way of stopping.
I see. Love is not a question of art, but of one's target. The important thing about love is not how one should love, but whom one should love. Is that it?
Of course.
Now, how does Adler define love relationships? Let's go over that.
I'm sure it'll just be another one of his tiresome idealistic theories.
First, Adler says this. We receive education on the task that is accomplished on one's own and on the work that is accomplished by 20 people, but we do not receive education on the task that is accomplished by two people.
The task that is accomplished by two people?
For example, the baby who could barely even turn over in bed manages to stand up on their own 2 feet and walk around. This is a task accomplished on one's own that they cannot get anyone else to do for them. Standing up and walking, learning words, and communicating. Moreover, philosophy, mathematics, physics, and every other field of study would qualify as a task accomplished on one's own.
I suppose they would.
By contrast, work is a task accomplished with one's comrades. Even with the kind of work that would seem to be undertaken on one's own, for example, that of a painter, there are always cooperators. The people who make the paints and paintbrushes, the people who make the canvases and easels, and then the purchasers at the art dealer. There is no such thing as work that can come into being without connections with other people and without cooperation.
Yes, that's true.
And we receive sufficient education in our homes and schools with regard to the tasks that are accomplished on one's own and the tasks that are accomplished with one's comrades. That's how it is, yes?
Well, yes, we teach it properly at our school, too.
The thing is, we receive no education whatsoever on the task to be accomplished by two people.
And that task to be accomplished by two people is?
The love that Adler speaks of.
So love is a task accomplished by two people. But we do not learn the art with which to accomplish that. Is it all right to understand it in this way?
Yes.
You realize that I'm not convinced by any of this, don't you?
Yes, this is nothing more than the gateway. What is love to the human being? What points are different between it and one's work relationships and friend relationships? And then, why do we need to love other people? Dawn is fast approaching. We do not have much time left. Let's think this over together and make every minute count.